Welcome to the Poundcast, the Digital Pound Foundation's podcast dedicated to explaining and discussing all aspects of the digital pound and the impact of new forms of digital money. Your host today is Jan Apache, Policy Lead and Executive Director of the Digital Pound Foundation. Today, Jana speaks to Duncan Trenholm, Managing Director and Global Co-Head of Digital Assets at TP ICAP, about why the firm became interested in digital assets for wholesale markets. He shares his insights on settlement, wholesale central bank digital currencies, and the barriers to mass adoption. Duncan and Jana also discuss how blockchain and distributed ledger technology are transforming financial markets and could lead to a more efficient, cost-effective, and interconnected global financial system.
Hi, Duncan. It's great to have you here with us today on the Poundcast. Really looking forward to hearing some of your views on digital asset markets and kind of the missing pieces when it comes to settlement and barriers to mass adoption and things like that. But let's start off with an introduction to you and your work at TP ICAP.
Thanks, Jana. It's a pleasure to be here. My name is Duncan Trenholm. So I'm a Managing Director and Global Co-Head of Digital Assets at TP ICAP. TP ICAP is a financial markets intermediary, and we're an interdealer broker, and we sit at the heart of wholesale financial markets. I've been at the organization coming up on 15 years, joined on the graduate program out of university, worked in the equities division of ICAP, which is one of the sub-brands under TP ICAP for about 8 to 10 years before moving across and starting the digital assets business at TP ICAP with my co-head, Simon Forster.
So let's start at the very beginning. First of all, not all of our listeners might be acquainted with the role of a firm like TP ICAP in the financial markets ecosystem. And so can you explain what TP ICAP does, what interdealer brokers do, and what is the value that they bring to the ecosystem?
Yeah, that's a really good question. An interdealer broker is a venue operator. So we provide marketplaces for financial instruments, energy instruments, and commodity instruments. So what that means is we're not an exchange, and we're primarily focused in the kind of over-the-counter markets, but we are a place where clients, and that can be anything from banks, the sell side, hedge funds, asset managers, pension funds on the buy side, commodity trading firms, energy producers, anyone that is a participant in sort of financial wholesale markets can trade various different financial products. So we're a global firm. We are actually, I believe, we operate the most regulated financial markets of anyone in the world. We have a variety of what's called ATSs in the US, which are regulated trading venues, SEFs as well, swap execution facilities. In Europe and the UK, we operate OTFs and MTFs, which are multilateral trading facilities and organized trading facilities. And then we also have regulated venues in places like Singapore and Hong Kong. And what we do is we provide a neutral venue for these clients to exchange risk, so manage their books through derivatives, and also transacting the kind of underlying spot markets across these financial, energy, and commodity markets. The organization grew out of, you know, what you would classify as voice broking. So that's where you have brokers who are managing prices between different clients, doing the kind of price discovery, and then matching these trades. You know, that's something that's evolved over the last 30, 40 years of finance. You know, it started originally with, you know, people in person together, managing bids and offers together. You know, once we had computers and PCs and the ability to, you know, use the phone and send orders and transmit orders electronically, that moved on to, you know, more digital ways of exchanging prices. And where we've ended up is a kind of hybrid model where we have brokers matching clients using what we call user interfaces, so screens that demonstrate where the prices are. And then we run a huge number of hybrid markets. And then alongside that, we also run fully electronic markets where clients are matching through fixed APIs and their orders are coming in electronically and they're matching against other clients electronically. So we're a big financial marketplace. And, you know, there's whether it's oil, whether it's equities, whether it's FX instruments, whether it's weather derivatives, these products are being traded on a day-to-day basis amongst our clients. And we're providing robust, regulated, orderly markets where clients can be certain that their orders will be managed in an appropriate manner and that these markets are run in an orderly manner.
So interdealer brokers like TPICAP play a really important role in creating liquidity and market making and basically ensuring the smooth operation, price formation and things like that of wholesale financial markets across multiple asset classes. They've been really embedded in financial markets infrastructure for a very long time, although how they operate has evolved, as you say. But why are IDBs like TPICAP interested in digital assets? What do you see as the potential in them, or what kind of client demands are you experiencing?
Great question. One point to make, by the way, we as an organization don't market make ourselves. And this is a really important distinction, which I think for those listeners that have been following crypto markets, is very topical in crypto markets at the moment. In operating a venue, we don't participate in our own order book, so we don't make prices ourselves. We provide the venue where clients can add liquidity to a market. But it's important to note that we are the operator of the venue, but we don't actually participate in it. And that's really important from a conflicts of interest perspective.
As we've seen in so many instances in the crypto world, which is probably why you're making this distinction very clear, I imagine.
Yeah, I think that if you run a venue and then you also have a market maker that participates in the order book, there have, you know, in traditional finance, there is now regulation in place, and it's been in place for a while to ensure that these things are segregated, separated, and there's appropriate controls to not mismanage interests and ensure clients are treated fairly. And, you know, I think if you don't separate these things up, there's always a temptation to give preferential treatment to your own market maker or for the market maker to, you know, try and increase volumes through wash trading to make it look like the exchange is doing more volume. These are things that, well, I don't know if happened, but we've certainly read about in the press, and there are allegations that this has happened at crypto exchanges over the years. But let's wind back a little bit. Back in 2017, our organization, as a, you know, large part of wholesale financial markets — wholesale, by the way, means that we are business to business, so we don't face retail customers — in order to come and participate at our markets, you need to be what's classified as a professional and eligible counterparty, meaning you're not a retail customer. And the reason for that is retail customers are subject to a much higher threshold in terms of protections, etc., and they need to trade through, certainly in the UK, regulated markets, as opposed to, say, MTFs or OTFs. So it's very much a venue for professional trading firms to match against each other. So back in 2017, we were receiving some client inbound across our organization as Bitcoin was on its parabolic run up to 20,000. And clients were asking what type of services could TPICAP provide in this asset class. And at the time, we didn't have anything across the organization really. But our CEO, a guy called Nicolas Breteau, put in place a working group and said, we want to understand, is crypto, the asset class, something that we should be looking to run wholesale markets in? And two, what is this technology, blockchain and DLT, and what does it mean for financial markets and the market structure and infrastructure? As a venue operator, we have a huge amount of infrastructure in order to allow clients to participate in financial markets. So what does this technology mean for that market structure moving forward? And is that going to be something that is going to challenge our business model? Is it something that we can utilize to improve our business model? So that was the concept of the working group. And it took us, I'd say, 18 months of market research, speaking to our traditional clients, so banks, asset managers, as they were looking at crypto and blockchain, but also reaching out and speaking to this whole new range of different businesses that had grown up in the crypto asset class, you know, fintechs, crypto exchanges, miners, crypto trading firms, to get a sense of what was going on. Scroll forward, the conclusion we came to is that this technology, blockchain or DLT, and I'll separate those up because, you know, I don't think it's clear yet in financial markets whether public blockchain infrastructure or permissioned private DLTs are where financial markets are going to congregate around in terms of a base layer technology that people utilize for settlement of different assets. It's, you know, there's definitely a direction of travel towards Ethereum on the public side in terms of different participants in financial markets innovating on that technology. But we also see, you know, several DLT-based platforms run by banks or run by consortiums that are getting some traction in the markets. But the conclusion we came to is this is fundamentally a better technology to store value, transfer value, settle value. And that comes about from the simple concept of people sharing a common ledger, being able to transfer at the speed of, you know, seconds or minutes or hours, as opposed to what we normally do in financial markets, which is, you know, T plus one. So that's trading day plus one or trading day plus two. And the ability to use smart contracts to actually write programs into the assets themselves so that the assets can become intelligent and can make decisions based on preset logic. All of those things added together give you this melting pot of possibility to run a much more efficient settlement process for value. And I say value really specifically because at its heart, everything that trades through traditional financial markets, whether that's physical assets, so think, you know, precious metals, other commodities like base metals, whether that be, you know, oil, gas, et cetera, they're often traded in dematerialized form. So through futures or, you know, contracts essentially that reference the underlying physical product, or things like equities or fixed income instruments like bonds, where they are, you know, dematerialized products in general because, you know, they're shares of ownership or debt instruments of some form. They're all what we would call value. So if this technology itself can move value around in a much easier, quicker, automated manner, we felt like that was going to have real impact on the way that traditional financial markets work. What we knew at that time back in 2019 was that it was probably going to take a while to see these traditional asset classes issued or represented in digital form. So as a token, say on a public blockchain or a private DLT, but you currently had crypto as an asset class which existed on this technology. So we think of that very much as the first asset class on this technology. So what we decided as an organization was, let's go on a journey to understand how to run a wholesale market in crypto, with the view that, first off, this is an important asset class that our clients are going to want to transact in. And two, by doing that, we're going to learn a lot of things about how this technology works. We're going to build some muscle memory as an organization about how to provide infrastructure in that. And over time, we'll be able to take those learnings and bring it to our traditional asset classes.
Thanks, Duncan. That was very comprehensive and I think answered a lot of my questions. This is great because I'm not having to say very much. You're just, you know, bringing it all out. So crypto is the kind of gateway asset class at the moment, but the future, in your view, is going to consist much more of a world in which traditional financial instruments are either tokenized, where they're, you know, things like equities and bonds, or else moved into more of a smart contract environment, like derivatives contracts and things like that. And by building the infrastructure now to support the existing institutional demand for crypto, you will be able to leverage that in the, basically you're building the foundations for the infrastructure that you'll need to support those more mature digital asset markets of the future. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's a fair summary.
Okay. So what are some of the barriers to mass adoption of digital assets? You've described so many of the potential benefits of tokenization and the use of smart contracts, particularly when they're applied to traditional financial markets. Why aren't we seeing more of this happening in practice at the moment? So what are some of the things, either from a technical perspective or regulatory perspective, or in terms of the market structure as it exists at the moment, that are stopping more widespread use and adoption of digital assets?
I think there are a variety of reasons. And I think it's important to say that in our view, this transition is maybe not multi-decade, but somewhere between a 10 and 20 year transition, of which we're probably, let's say, 5 years into. I think one of the major reasons is that holding a digital asset through digital custody, i.e. in a digital wallet of some form, is not a capability that any participant within financial markets had prior to crypto coming on the scene. As such, all of the participants within financial markets are having to go through a process of understanding how to hold these assets. For firms that have a big risk appetite, they sensed an opportunity in crypto, you know, dating back to maybe even 10 years back in general. And they mobilized quickly to build, often at that time, build custody themselves so that they could hold these blockchain-based assets and interact in the asset class. And those were, you know, what we classify as non-bank market makers, almost fintech-like firms, as well as sort of trading firms that could take their market making strategies, their systematic trading strategies, and apply it to this new asset class. For firms with maybe a lower risk appetite or that are subject to more regulation, so think, you know, banks, etc., the process of getting digital custody is quite lengthy. As an example, a lot of firms send out these what are called RFIs, where they're requesting information from different service providers. They will review the offerings out there in the market. They will go to great lengths, you know, hundreds and hundreds of questions about the security processes, how the infrastructure is set up, what its failover processes are like, in order to determine through a procurement process what it is that or which vendor they want to go with if they decide not to build it themselves. That is just a often multi-year journey in order to choose a service provider, integrate it with the, you know, bank or asset manager or hedge fund systems into their kind of portfolio management systems, their reconciliation systems to check and ensure that it works effectively. And all of that only comes when a decision is made internally to actually mobilize into this asset class or this product. And there has to be a commercial reason for a financial firm to do that. One of the things that is a bit of a catalyst at the moment to driving organizations to set up digital custody is the demand that they have from their clients or, you know, internal desks that want to trade this product for crypto itself. So to that extent, crypto has been somewhat of a catalyst to forcing financial firms to engage with blockchain technology and understand how it works and how to custody these products. So that's one thing that just doesn't happen overnight, unfortunately. What we believe is as firms go through this process, once they have set up digital custody, they will realize over time that that infrastructure can be used for other products, not just crypto. There are many investment banks at the moment that are looking at tokenizing, issuing onto some public, some private infrastructure. At its heart, that is still a token that exists on a blockchain that needs a digital wallet to hold it. So this crypto, the interest and the growth in the crypto asset class is driving clients to set up functionality for holding these products. And of course, there's another segment of the market that, you know, don't have the appetite for crypto, don't see client demand, or don't want to enter that asset class currently. For them to go through that infrastructure lift and set up this type of product, it's, you know, they need to find another reason for that. And that's been slower in terms of, you know, there aren't many digital bonds. Well, there's probably about 30 digital bonds as of the last time that we checked. You know, there's been proof of concepts, so early products in things like tokenized gold. You know, you've got a range of stable coins now that look a bit like a parallel FX market, but there hasn't been the same level of interest in those products yet. And I think to really realize the benefits of a blockchain-based settlement infrastructure, you need a critical mass of customers all on that infrastructure in order for smart contracts to genuinely be used and have enough participants that you can, you know, run these processes and everybody's got a digital wallet for this to be able to be used at scale. And that's just a slow move, but the direction of travel is very clear. And every year, there are more firms that are becoming digitally enabled. And I think it will be a somewhat of a drip, drip, drip flood moment once you hit critical mass across the industry.
Thanks, Duncan. Let's talk about the settlement side of things. If I want to settle a digital asset, whether it's cryptocurrency or a tokenized bond or something like that, obviously the ideal would be to settle it on Ledger as well to fully benefit from, you know, the potential that instantaneous or near instantaneous DLT-based settlement has to offer, or, you know, having trade lifecycle events on a smart contract for a derivative automated and kind of processed automatically and things like that. What are some of the barriers there? So what are some of the challenges with the current settlement assets available? And here I'm probably referring to stablecoins more than anything else. And how do you see some of those challenges being effectively resolved over time?
That is a very interesting question. I think that one challenge is interoperability between different blockchains and DLTs. So cross-chain solutions that allow some form of delivery versus payment mechanism when you have, you know, settlement on ETH for one side or settlement on a private chain operated by a bank on the other side. That's certainly one thing. The other is many transactions are still denominated in fiat currency on the traditional financial system, which has a cadence and pace, which is slower in places and also not 24/7 in places, given weekends, etc. So if you are trying to settle a trade that has a blockchain-based asset on one side that can go at minutes or hours, and the other side is a traditional banking-based payment, and you're trying to do it on the weekend, then there are some obvious frictions there. I think one of the things that's interesting about this tech is the ability to not just aspire towards atomic settlement, meaning immediate settlement straight after a trade, but to aspire towards precision settlement. And I think that's, you know, to give credit where credit's due, I first heard that term off Matthew McDermott, who is head of digital assets at Goldman Sachs. But I think it's a really interesting concept around, I don't think all markets would necessarily suit immediate atomic settlement, because one of the things I don't think that's discussed enough in the market is if you are going to settle immediately, you need to ensure that there's collateral available, i.e. the asset available to settle immediately. That is a huge mindset shift to how traditional markets operate. In T+1, T+2 markets, often trades are done and operations teams and settlements teams essentially manage collateral behind the scenes in terms of, do we need to borrow in collateral in order to settle this trade? You know, what do we have in the depot available for this trade? If you start to shift towards a much more immediate type settlement, you need to have all of your collateral ready to settle immediately. And of course, that would increase the utility of assets. You can trade in and out immediately and then go and trade in and out somewhere else. But that might not always be the most efficient way for a market to operate, because, you know, if you have some delay between trade and settlement, whether that's, you know, once an hour you settle, it does mean that you are able to get some benefits in terms of netting, i.e. collapsing down the trading that you do between two counterparts and making the, you know, resultant end settlement slightly more efficient and probably cheaper, because you're not transferring back and forth the whole time. You can just settle the net result of that trade. And I think one of the concepts to get across here is you have this continuum between trading and settling as quickly as possible and the risk that builds up in a financial system as a result. Because as soon as you introduce a delay between trade and settlement, you're taking on some form of counterparty risk. Is that counterparty going to deliver that asset when they are supposed to? Most of the time they do, but they, you know, there are big examples where counterparts go bust essentially and you don't get the assets that you are supposed to have. And that's an issue, and a big issue across financial markets, where we clients in general manage risk against each other, exposure against each other, or we have this whole system of central clearers, clearing firms that take on that risk amongst a market of participants and centralize that risk in one place. You know, that system is, it works, and it's been proven to work with, you know, margin that each counterpart pays into the central clearer to backstop if there are any issues. But I'll tell you this, it's incredibly expensive to operate a market like that. And one of the things that I think we need to look at with blockchain tech is, now that we can be precise around when we settle and we can use smart contracts to do things like DVP, how can we build a system that is much cheaper for investors, where you aren't having to pay huge sums, either from late settlement fines to clearing firms, in order to operate these markets in a safe and robust manner?
That is super interesting, especially on the funding side. And I know, you know, in the past, I think we've done podcasts with Olaf Ransom and Nick Philpott, both more on the wholesale side, where we've discussed this challenge as well around, you know, the potential for atomic settlement, the potential for things to happen very fast, but also how from a funding, liquidity management, kind of treasury management side of thing, that opens, that is a whole, you know, nightmare scenario, because you almost need that kind of latency in order to effectively view and manage your risk. So that being the Digital Pound Foundation, of course, I'm going to ask you about CBDC, and in this case, the potential for, you know, the introduction of wholesale CBDCs globally by various jurisdictions to be an enabler of the growth of digital asset markets, particularly, I think, in the UK, where there has been very little discussion around wholesale CBDC, but there's some interesting projects going on in the private sector, such as the Regulated Liabilities Network or Finality. How do you see these sorts of innovations in terms of wholesale settlement impacting the growth and evolution of digital asset markets?
In order to settle effectively, some of the things I just talked about were ensuring that you can settle the trade on the same network pace as your asset is being transferred. And that's really important to manage that risk between counterparties and market participants. One of the reasons why stable coins, so think Tether, USDC, have become so prevalent in crypto markets and the industry relies on those hugely is because the asset there, so the, you know, US dollar equivalent stable coin that trades are denominated in, can be moved and settled on the same technology as the, you know, the crypto assets themselves. And that means clients can, when they are engaging in the crypto financial market, they can manage the settlement of the product at the same pace. So that's really important. And I think there are friction points when you are trying to settle versus, you know, US fiat, US dollar on the, you know, traditional banking system. However, each of those stable coins comes with a credit risk in itself. So credit risk against Tether, the organization, and how efficiently and robustly they are managing that peg between the US dollar in the fiat system and the US dollar issuance on the, you know, blockchain system. USDC, Tether have different credit risks, I would say, and clients manage that themselves. And when I say manage that, I mean they will be careful to what exposure and how many of these assets they are trading in. Because again, if it was found that one of these stable coins didn't have the reserves to back their stable coin, then obviously that would have some dramatic impact on the value of the stable coin that you are holding. So that space has huge room for, I would say, improvement. And, you know, there are likely to be stablecoin issuances from private banks, from banks in general, as well as CBDCs. And I think that each of those come with a different credit risk. And obviously, central bank money in general is a money that trading firms, market participants in general have huge trust in. So being able to bring CBDCs into a wholesale market and use that as the settlement asset for all sorts of different trades, whether that be crypto trades, whether that be digital bond trades, whether that be digital gold, that would be a huge improvement that would underpin the stability of that market. And I think is something that would be, you know, greatly welcomed within that kind of digital market infrastructure in general.
Thanks so much, Duncan. And finally, to wrap things up, what excites you most personally about the developments that you're seeing in the digital asset space? What do you see as having the most potential for the future?
So over at TPI Cap, we run a voice broking desk that matches clients from our traditional client base and clients that have grown up in the crypto ecosystem on regulated crypto derivative products. So things like CME, Bitcoin futures, Bitcoin options, Ether futures, Ether options. We've also recently launched last month a wholesale spot exchange for crypto, where you can trade Bitcoin US dollar, ETH US dollar through a TPI cap exchange that's FCA registered, launched in the UK with a segregated custody at Fidelity Digital Assets, who are also an FCA registered custodian. So those were the two main products that we've launched to date that have allowed us to service our customer base in crypto and build infrastructure in crypto markets in general. I think what excites me the most is the financial market infrastructure in general has been greatly improved from a trading experience over the last 20 years. And that's largely come through electronification. We now have central limit order books, requests for quotes. Clients are able to trade and enter bids and offers on a microsecond basis and match against each other. It's, you know, not frictionless, but the cost for investors has come down dramatically and the price discovery process has been greatly improved. And that has generally led to a more efficient market for clients to be able to access and trade products. I think, however, that financial markets in general are still suffering from huge problems and costs on that post-trade settlement custody side, where many of the systems and processes we have in place are, you know, 20, 30 years old and have been somewhat iteratively approved. But, you know, there is a reason why regulators are out there saying we would like to move from T2 to T1 and why this is an incredibly difficult thing to do, because changing that legacy technology, changing the operational mindset that firms have, what we talked about previously in terms of the kind of treasury management and the collateral management side of things, is incredibly difficult to do. What excites me the most is you're seeing this parallel financial system being built on blockchain, and crypto markets are kind of the first marketplace built on top of that. But all the firms trading in these crypto markets, and yes, there's been problems, and yes, you know, regulation needs to come in to set the ground rules in a way to make it safe for investors. But the firms there are learning to have business models, operational models that are tailored to a technology which can do things in a much more automated and quicker manner. And I think that that's really exciting, because ultimately, if we can take what we've learned there and use those processes and bring them to traditional financial markets, you're going to end up with a system which is much more efficient, cheaper for investors, which is ultimately the goal. And I think, to speak tangibly about one thing, every asset class at the moment is almost on a different infrastructure. Like derivatives settle through derivative exchanges and clearing firms, equities, you know, settle through equities exchanges, and they have a different market structure to FX markets, where you've got these network of prime brokers that kind of deal with each other as opposed to central clearing firms. You have no ability as a client to trade between an equity product and a fixed income product or into a gold product directly. You know, and that just introduces this huge cost and sort of issues and problems into this system. Imagine a world where everything exists as a token and you can bilaterally trade any token for any other token, and the trading possibilities that will come for that and the efficiency gains you'll get from that. Things like that, I think, are powerful. I see clients out there, I see partners out there excited by the possibility of offering this kind of agnostic infrastructure for lots of different tokens, irrespective of what the token reference is. You know, I think that's something to aspire to and something that people building in digital markets would like to get to in the future.
Thanks so much, Duncan. It's been absolutely fascinating to listen to you today, and I hope all our listeners enjoy this as much as I've enjoyed recording it. I think we could go on for ages, but we should probably stop there. But thank you so much again for coming on the Poundcast.
No, thank you very much, Janet. It was a pleasure to be here, and I look forward to listening to future podcasts from you.